time is ticking out by the Cranberries. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. The United States on Tuesday vetoed a widely supported Security Council resolution demanding an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. The vote was 13-1 in favor of the resolution, with the United Kingdom abstaining. It marked the third time the U.S. has vetoed a Security Council resolution demanding a ceasefire in Gaza. The vote came a day after the U.S. circulated a rival resolution calling for a temporary ceasefire linked to the release of all Israeli hostages. Nearly 30,000 Palestinians have been killed in Israel's assault on Gaza over the past 4.5 months, with thousands more missing and presumed dead under the rubble. Nearly 70,000 people have been wounded. 80% of Gaza's population has been displaced, while a humanitarian crisis continues to worsen, with a quarter of Palestinians in Gaza facing starvation. The Biden administration's support for Israel and its assault on Gaza has come under fierce criticism, both around the world and here at home. In Michigan, which is a key battleground state, home to one of the largest Arab American populations in the country, a campaign is growing to vote uncommitted in next week's Democratic primary in protest of President Biden's policies backing Israel. For more, we're joined by two guests. Michigan State Representative Abraham Ayash is the Michigan House Majority Floor Leader, the second-ranking Democrat in the Michigan House. Representative Ayash was among several Arab and Muslim leaders who met with Biden officials in Dearborn last week after refusing to meet with Biden's campaign manager, Julie Chavez Rodriguez. He's also joined more than 40 other Michigan elected officials in pledging to cast a vote for uncommitted in Michigan's February 27th primary. He's joining us from Detroit. Joining us from Washington, D.C., on his way to Michigan, is Democratic Congressmember Ro Khanna. He's the deputy whip of the Congressional Progressive Caucus and is going to Michigan tomorrow to meet with Muslim and Arab American leaders in the state. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Abraham Ayash, let's begin with you. What are you demanding as a Michigan House Majority Floor Leader? What are you demanding of the Biden administration? You don't usually take such stands against your own party. But right now, the Democratic Party is really dealing with enormous pressure at this point. Can you talk about what you want to see happen?
Look, I think our demands are simple. We just don't want our government, our country, to support, to aid, to abet any operation that kills innocent men, women, and children. It is not a radical idea for us to suggest that the richest and most powerful country in the history of the world should not be funding what we see as a genocide, that we have seen nearly 30,000 dead Palestinians at the hands of U.S.-funded Israeli missiles and bombs. And we want our leadership to not engage in that type of moral failure and that degenerative act that does not dignify the humanity of the Palestinian people. So, you know, more than anything, we're not standing against anyone, but we're simply reaffirming our stance for humanity and for the basic tenets of human rights, which says it is not a crazy concept that we should not be supporting any effort that is killing any innocent person in the world, especially to the magnitude that we've seen in Gaza, where more people have died in this conflict than any war since World War II, which is just a devastating toll. And we're hoping to exercise our right. We're going to use the ballot box on February 27th to show that we are going to not support any effort that is supporting a genocide, and that we're going to stand firm and hopefully allow this administration to change course before the November election.
Well, I wanted to ask Congressman Ro Khanna, who's with us as well. You said that, for example, that President Trump is too dangerous to not support former President Trump is too dangerous to not support President Biden. Your response to those Democrats who cannot, in good conscience, vote for President Biden, at least in this primary?
Well, first of all, I have a tremendous amount of respect for Representative Ayash, and I'm looking forward to seeing him in Michigan. I do believe the administration needs to change course in foreign policy in the Middle East in order to gain the trust of people who we have lost. You can't just meet with the Muslim American or Arab American community and then veto in the United Nations a resolution calling for a ceasefire and, by the way, an unconditional release of the hostages. This is the third time we have vetoed that. It is hurting our moral standing. It is hurting our commitment to human rights. And it is not giving confidence to people that you're hearing them and changing course. So my hope is in my meetings with Representative Ayash and others that we can come up with a strategy that helps change course in the Middle East so we get a permanent ceasefire, so we have a release of the hostages, so we get aid into Gaza, and we have more peace and justice in the region.
And Representative Ayash, I wanted to ask you about the meeting you had with Biden officials earlier this month in Dearborn. What did you get out of those talks?
We're firm in reiterating our points. We want to see an immediate permanent ceasefire. We want to see humanitarian aid delivered to the people of Gaza through entities like UNRWA. And we want to see restrictions and conditions on the aid that is sent to Israel. You know, it is unfathomable that we just send a blank check with no conditions to a country that has violated human rights, that has violated international law over and over and over again. And we reminded the administration that, one, they showed up 124 days into this conflict. They visited a state that happens to be the swing state. So we are not seeing the level of support. We're not seeing the level of concern that our communities have demonstrated for months. And we reiterated those messages once again. And unfortunately, just 4 days after that meeting, we saw the Netanyahu regime did one of the worst attacks on the Rafah region, and the United States still did not put the type of pressure on that regime to stop these heinous acts.
Let me ask Congressmember Khanna, do you think the Biden administration made a mistake in vetoing yet another ceasefire resolution? And I want to go a little further. Right after the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations issued that veto, President Biden was in Los Angeles at a fundraiser. He was attending a high-dollar fundraiser with the media mogul Chaim Saban, well-known Democratic pro-Israel billionaire. The dinner, the meeting was at, what, $3,300 to cost as much as $250,000. I'm looking at a piece now in Common Dreams. Your thoughts on this and on President Biden continually saying he's putting enormous pressure privately on Netanyahu, yet their public acts continue to be against the kind of ceasefire that was put forward and vetoed at the United Nations?
It was a mistake to veto the United Nations resolution. At the very least, we could have abstained. I mean, you have 15 countries on that Security Council. 13 of them are voting for a resolution for a permanent ceasefire and a release of all hostages, which is the sentiment, not just in the world, it's the sentiment about the majority of American people. And we are the lone no vote in the global community. It is hurting America's standing in the world, especially an administration that is committed to multilateralism and rebuilding international institutions. What does this say about the credibility of the UN if we aren't going to participate in those institutions? The other issue is that I appreciate that there has been some movement in the administration because of many of us in Congress who have called for a permanent ceasefire, who have called for the humanitarian aid to Gaza. There has been movement in recognizing the value and dignity of Palestinian lives and the humanitarian concerns. But now we need action. There needs to be clear consequences to Netanyahu and his very far right-wing government. I mean, people in his government are way to the right of Donald Trump, and that is important to understand. People like Ben-Gvir, it needs to be clear to Bibi, he can't go into Rafah. Our Secretary of Defense doesn't want it. Our president doesn't want it. Who is he to defy the United States of America and then expect us to continue to provide military aid to do that? So we need to be very, very clear of the consequences, and that is not what has happened so far.
Representative Ayash, I wanted to ask you, in December, you embarked on a hunger strike and joined a demonstration outside the White House to call for a ceasefire. Why is this issue so deeply personal to you?
Look, my chief of staff is on. Her two aunts were one of the victims of the Nakba. And I remember her telling me the story where her father and his two sisters walked across the Jordan Valley only for the two aunts to pass away from dehydration. You know, there's a real pain and real history behind the dehumanization of the Palestinian people. And we've seen people all across this country stand up and say, our country should not be looking by while all these innocent men, women, and children are suffering at the hands of a right-wing regime that Congressman Khanna mentioned that we are funding. You know, if you look at the facts, a majority of Americans, 80% of Democrats support a ceasefire, over 60% of Americans support a ceasefire. Yet we see a majority of Congress and this White House just seem to ignore the will of the American people. You know, that is just a uniquely un-American concept when you have folks for months who have protested, folks for months who have stood up and said, we demand that our country lead with moral conviction and say that no innocent man, woman, and child should be murdered at the hands of U.S. weaponry. And our leaders just seem to ignore it. And I'm grateful for leaders like Congressman Khanna, who has stood firmly and supporting human rights, who stood firmly in saying that Palestinians deserve just as much dignity as the Ukrainians, as the Israelis, as anyone in this world. But to see our leaders continue to ignore the will of the American people is extremely disheartening. And, you know, that is why this issue is so important for so many people across this country, because it is a reminder that we are going to continue to fight for our democracy and continue to fight for democratic values and ideals. And it is through things like voting uncommitted and continuing to organize and protest for peace all across the world.
Congressmember Khanna, you said there needs to be consequences to affect Israeli policy. Do you think that the U.S. should cut off military aid to Israel, to Prime Minister Netanyahu, for what they're doing in Gaza right now? And if you can talk about the big meeting you're going to have tomorrow evening with Rashida Tlaib, the Take Back Our Power campaign. Rashida Tlaib, the only Palestinian-American member of the U.S. Congress.
Well, I voted no on the blank check, $17 million of unrestricted money to Israel just a week or two ago. And I certainly don't think we should be giving them more of the precision missiles, which would go to attack people in Rafah. I don't see how we can bypass Congress, which has been happening to provide offensive military weapons to undertake strikes that our own government is saying should not happen. Let me just say this. I'm really looking forward first to meeting people like Representative Aya and other Arab American, Muslim American leaders. He's not just a representative. He is the leader in the Michigan House. He's going to be a future governor, future senator, future member of Congress. And this is the point. The coalition of the modern Democratic Party is not the coalition of 1972. It is a coalition that includes young people, progressives, Muslim Americans, Arab Americans, Jewish Americans, young folks. The AME Black Church has come out for a ceasefire. And we better wake up to that fact, because the future of the Democratic Party is going to demand justice for two states, a Palestinian state living side by side with an Israeli state, and is going to demand concrete actions for a ceasefire and recognizing the humanity of both Palestinians and Israelis. The conversation with Rashida Tlaib is one about electricity and power and justice on that, though I'm sure other topics will come up at that town hall.
We want to thank you both for being with us. California Congressmember Ro Khanna, headed to Michigan tomorrow, and Abraham Ayash, speaking to us from Detroit, the Michigan House Majority Floor Leader. The Michigan primary is February 27th. That's next week in Michigan. When we come back, leaders at this year's African Union summit condemn Israel's assault on Gaza. We'll get the latest and also hear decisions they made around Sudan, around the Democratic Republic of Congo, and more. Stay with us. What It Is by Samer. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Leaders at this year's African Union summit in the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa, have condemned Israel's assault on Gaza and called for its immediate end. The chair of the African Union Commission, Moussa Faki, on Saturday said Israel's offensive was, quote, the most flagrant violation of international humanitarian law, and accused Israel of having, quote, exterminated Gaza's residents. Meanwhile, Azali Assoumani, president of the Comoros and the outgoing chairperson of the African Union, praised the case brought by South Africa against Israel at the International Court of Justice, where the court ruled there's plausible case that Israel's committing genocide in Gaza. During last year's AU summit, an Israeli delegate was removed from the plenary hall amidst a disagreement over Israel's observer status at the African Union. For more, we're joined by Nanjala Niebola, a writer and political analyst from Kenya, joining us from London. Thank you so much for being with us, Nanjala. If you can start off on Gaza, this meeting this past weekend in Ethiopia, where you even had Lula, the president of Brazil, coming to address the group and saying that Israel was committing genocide in Gaza, whereupon Israel's prime minister said that Lula is persona non grata in Israel. But talk about the significance of the meeting on Gaza, and then we'll move on to other issues.
Sure. Thank you for having me, Amy. I think it's important to understand that the African Union, as a bloc, has been a consistent supporter of Palestinian rights since 1972 and arguably since 1948. Many of African nations see similarities between, and they see really an identical experience between Palestinian occupation and what they have endured as under colonization. And so there's a lot of empathy there, and there's a lot of resonance there. It's important, though, to distinguish the position of the African Union from the position of individual member states. So while the union itself has been consistent and has always held the line that Palestinian independence was an integral part of the African Union's foundational documents and foundational position in international relations, various African nations, because there is no impetus from the African Union for there to be always a single position within each country, various African nations do have different relationships with both Israel and Palestine. So, for example, while every single country in Africa except one recognizes the state of Palestine, the recognition of the state of Israel has varied. There was a time in after the 1972 war where African nations wholesale declared that they would not recognize the state of Israel, but that has changed considerably. Similarly, in relation to the African Union itself, the Palestinian territories have had observer status at the African Union since 2013. And so you mentioned how the Israeli representative of the African to the African Union was asked to leave the meeting of the African Union in 2013. 2022. This is really because there's been a lot of back and forth about whether or not the African Union as a body should recognize Israel as a observer. Observers do not get to vote, obviously, on various issues that are before the African Union, but they do get to participate in meetings, and they do get to contribute to conversations in some ways. And so it is an important thing to be an observer at the African Union, and Israel has made significant diplomatic inroads in this regard. But the position of the African Union as a, which is the head of states, the meeting of the head of states is the most senior decision-making entity within the African Union, as opposed to the commission, which oversees the day-to-day running of the organization. The position of the African Union heads of states has always been that Israel did not have that observer status, and this was the back and forth, that the commission had taken an action that the union itself had not endorsed, and this is why the Israeli representative was asked to leave. This remains a position of contention, and the increase of the violence in Gaza has only made it clear that the African Union is going to remain with the historical position, which is recognition of the Palestinian territories and a demand that there is adherence to international law on the issue of Palestine, and that includes the occupation, predates October 7th, goes all the way back to every single UN resolution that has been passed on the issue to date. That's the official African Union position, and what we've seen in this last week is a reinforcement of that position, a reification of that position.
Nangela Nyabola, you've spoken in the past about Namibia, which before Palestine was the last country where international law on occupation was tested. South Africa occupied Namibia until 1994. What were the lessons here, and how did they shape the knowledge of the terrain of occupation and its impact on people being occupied?
It's really been one of the most interesting developments in international relations in relation to Gaza, is that we're finally seeing this recollection of the fact that African connection with Palestine, A, is not a new thing, and there's been a long history of solidarity and support with liberation movements, particularly the ANC in South Africa and SWAPO in Namibia. So as you mentioned, Namibia was an occupied territory, was occupied by the apartheid government of South Africa until 1994. And SWAPO and the ANC both worked together to end that occupation, but also collaborated with the Palestinian Liberation Authority, Palestinian Liberation Organization, to try and coordinate whether it was a political support at the international level, which was a crucial element of ending that, but also through the trusteeship mechanism. Namibia was under the UN trusteeship commission, through the trusteeship mechanism, trying to find ways of negotiating independence for Namibia and protecting Namibia from further South African incursion. South African apartheid government's relationship with its neighbors was always fraught. There were frequent bombing campaigns that happened in Botswana. There was fighting in Mozambique and in Namibia. And so there was always this tension between the apartheid government and governments in the region. And so Palestine, in that regard, becomes a natural ally because that experience of occupation is very similar. And so when we saw at the ICJ this week, the Palestinian submission to the ICJ, there was this recollection of the fact that SWAPO and ANC have always been allies of Palestinian liberation. And what we're seeing with this Palestinian reinforcement of international law is not a new occurrence. It's something that South Africa and Namibia both learned keenly through the process of fighting for independence and the end of apartheid, and they would like to see it replicated in the way the Palestinian issue is handled at the international level. And that is, once again, this is what stick to the letter of the law, because this law exists for a reason, and this law came through for Namibia. Can it provide the same protection for Palestinian people?
Very interesting that at the International Court of Justice yesterday, in this six-day hearing that's taking place, where more than a quarter of the UN's countries, it's the largest gathering ever, will be speaking against Israel's occupation of the Palestinian territories. Namibia spoke, of course, South Africa, which has brought this other case around the genocide case against Israel. And also you have the U.S. vetoing the UN Security Council resolution yesterday for a ceasefire that was brought by Algeria, a country that was occupied by France by more than a century. Nangela, if you could address that and then move on to the DRC and the issues raised there around the warring that's going on in eastern Congo, and particularly around Rwanda's role with the M23.
So one of the important things to remember is that diplomatically at the international level, African countries are the most cohesive voting bloc, certainly at the United Nations, but in other international forums. And this is because, again, as I mentioned, the African Union mechanisms for deliberation are actually incredibly strong. When there is an African line on an issue, there's a lot of negotiation that precedes that. But countries tend to vote by the line, and there tends to be very much a consistent diplomatic front. And this is one reason why Israel, for example, has tried very hard to make inroads with the diplomatic community in Africa, because on all of the votes that have come down the General Assembly that I've consistently criticized Israel, even at the Security Council, anything that's managed to get through that has criticized Israel, African countries have consistently voted in favor of these resolutions. And so there is actually this bigger issue of numbers. You know, we tend to think about power in international relations in terms of military strength and in terms of financial strength. But what Africa has at the international level is just sheer numbers. We're talking about 54 countries that have a very interconnected view of history and tend to work together and cooperate together and bring those numbers together for all of these international votes. And so Algeria is a big country on the continent, even though it might not seem that way externally. But Algeria has been one of the most consistent defenders of Palestinian liberation on the continent, came out very strongly against Israeli diplomatic presence at the AU, came out very strongly in favor of Palestinian independence, in supporting the Palestinian liberation organizations. And so it's not a surprise to see that Algeria at the Security Council would take this very strong position, because it is very consistent with Algerian diplomatic history. And as you said, it is because Algeria has endured several, you know, decades of French occupation that culminated in one of the most violent wars of independence that we've really ever seen globally. And, you know, France is still in the process of trying to make reparations for this, because for Algerians, it remains a very sore spot in history, and it remains to be a very, you know, fraught question between France-Franco-Algerian relationships. So I'm not surprised to see Algeria bring this resolution forward, just like, you know, as you've probably heard from American analysts, you know, it was not a surprise that the UN voted, even though it was a disappointment, that the US voted in the way that it did. And I think we're going to expect to see a lot more coordinated action being led by nations like Algeria, South Africa. All of these countries that have historically supported Palestinian liberation in Africa will continue to toe this line, because it is not just a question of it's a question of history. It's a question of solidarity. It's a question of shared experiences of all of these systemic types of violence.
And Nangela, we only have less than a minute left, but I wanted to ask you about all of the heightened anti-colonial sentiment that has swept across Central Africa and the Sahel region, with numerous coups in the region in recent years. How has this affected the dynamics at the AU?
It's definitely complicated things, and there's probably three things that I would point out. One is that this is not happening in a vacuum. We are also feeling the secondary effects of the ongoing war in Ukraine, Russia's ongoing war in Ukraine. The Sahel region has historically attracted a great deal of attention because it has been the crossroads of trade between Africa and Europe, but it's also been, in contemporary history, the main pathway through which migrants from as far afield as Bangladesh, but also from the continent, cross the Mediterranean to get into southern Europe. So in terms of international diplomacy, it's attracted a great deal of attention from Europe. There's a great deal of financing for migration management. There's a great deal of financing for ending wars that have happened in the region. At the same time, you have this young generation. Remember that Africa is the youngest continent in the world. You have this young generation, many of these cool
leaders. Nangela, we're going to have to wrap there, but we're going to continue and post online at democracynow.org. Nangela Nubola, speaking to us from London. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
For 40 years, the Simon Fraser Public Interest Research Group, a.k.a. SFPIRG, has been helping students build communities at SFU. Campus organizations like Out on Campus and Embark developed out-of-action groups at SFPIRG. Action groups are one of the ways that student activists can take action for change. Visit us at www.sfpirg.ca. That's www.sfpirg.ca. sfpirg.ca to learn more about starting your own action group today.
You're listening